Good afternoon. So, last time we extended our page tables to support larger virtual addresses more efficiently, using the assumption that, well, most programs might have a lot of virtual addresses technically available to them as far as like things they could put in a pointer and potentially use at some point, but usually most of those virtual addresses that are possible will not actually be valid. They won't point to memory that actually is set up. So we can omit sort of large portions of what would be all our page table entries, and the way we do that is with this tree-like structure, where we take our single level page table design and kind of just repeat it a couple times, where we use the first layer of page tables to find the second, to find the third, until we get back to the final address, which we use to access the actual program data or code. And in doing this, we take our virtual page number, which previously was the index into the page table, and we divide it up into parts, use each part as an index for each level of the table. And rather than using the page table base register for anything but the first level, we use the result of the previous level. And we save space for these large regions of invalid pages, because if at one of the higher levels of the table, one of the earlier ones, we find that it's not marked valid, we just stop. Therefore, we don't need to even have anything stored for the later levels for that range of addresses. So, questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
What do I mean by the result of the previous level?
So, since I have this diagram here, from talking about the quiz, right? At each level, we're going to look up a page table entry, and kind of typically, that would give us the location of the actual code or data. In our single level scheme here, it's going to give us the location of the place to do the next lookup of the same type. And there's some conversion we learned when looking at the details that we'll actually get a physical page number. So in the example on the quiz, for example, at the first level here, we had a page table entry that said the PPN physical page number was 54, and that gave us a starting base address of 540000 with our page size. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I'll talk a bit about some things on the quiz that I thought I really didn't do that. Okay, great. Really didn't update these slides. Okay, so I'll talk briefly about, from my notes here, about some of the earlier quiz questions. So a lot of people missed quiz question 1B, which was asking about, after the process does some accesses that happen to use the heap, could writing to the heap trigger an exception? And I think there are kind of two things that might be tripping people up here. So one is that, we talked about doing allocate on demand, so we know some writes trigger exceptions to allocate things. So you might say, well, that still needs to happen, and just assume that. But we've accounted for, the heap already, because we can look at our accesses. I should do this here, and find out that we already wrote to part of the heap. Now, that doesn't, of course, mean that we allocated the whole heap, because the problem said we only allocate the minimum amounts. But when the OS allocates memory, it has to allocate it by setting a page table entry up. So that means it can only allocate a whole page from offset 0 to the maximum offset. And in this case, that would allocate the page of the heap that starts at address 500, and ends at 5FF, and the one that starts at 600, and ends at 6FF, because that's the only way we can let the program access this range of addresses that spans the two pages. Even though it's less than a page, it turns out we need to allocate two whole pages to let the program complete those accesses. And that means the whole heap, which is only two pages in this case, will be allocated. So writing to any part of it won't need an exception because we set up the page tables already. Yes? So your question is, could we somehow only allocate one page, observing that, oh, this program only needs the upper half of this page and the lower half of the other page? So not with the functionality available to us, because we need to be able to handle what if the program uses the rest of these pages. And the problem is, if we set up the pages as sort of accessible, we've lost our opportunity to detect future accesses. We set them up as sort of fully accessible, readable, and writable. So like the only way we could effectively do that is if we could like leave them read-only, but that means that writing to the page is going to be incredibly inefficient. So it's not just not practical for that reason. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Why would at least two physical pages be allocated to store the processes of global variables?
Why would at least two physical
pages? I guess why are A and C accepted for either option?
Why are A and C accepted for either answer? I said about what happens with the heap and stack. I didn't say heap, stack, and global variables. I meant to, but I did not. So I just dropped those two options for that reason. Yeah?
And what would they have been if you had said?
If I said they were allocated on demand, in that case, the answer to A would be false, because we haven't written to the whole global variable region. We've only written to the first page of it, so the second page is still unallocated. And the answer to C would be false for the same reason. Yes?
Wouldn't A be true in that case?
Yes, sorry. I mean, the answer to A would be true because we wouldn't have allocated the page starting half of one of the pages of that global variable region. Okay, and I think I should look at my notes over here. And on question two, a lot of people missed D and B and D. So with B, remember the way copy on write works is that we look for, if we have, we copy things only if the program writes to it, and in this case, after the fork, neither the child or parent process has written to the page containing the address 500. That means that if they do write to it, we need to make a copy, so we need to be able to detect that. If the OS wants to detect that, it needs to make the write trigger an exception. So that makes B true, and D is false because when we make copies to store the stacks, only the page OXE of the two stacks has been modified, so we'll have two copies of those, and we can still share the page with virtual page OXF. Yes? So the question is for B, given that we've already allocated one of the pages, why would an exception occur? So remember, with copy on write, the issue isn't that we haven't allocated the pages, it's that we're sharing these pages that are allocated between two processes. So we haven't made the copies yet. And that's something we can do in addition to allocate on demand, if we want to. In this case, we were not doing it in addition to allocate on demand. But it would be it's a separate decision for the OS to set up pages for copy on write from allocate on demand. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yes?
Why is A not true?
Why is A not true? if we, where is my cursor? I can do this better. Cursor is, well, there, and then, oh. So if we, there, if we go, look up, oh, if you look up, we haven't done anything in the child process. Well, we've done things in the child process to the stack, which is in that page. And therefore, the child process has a private copy of the stack already from the previous accesses. That's a virtual address, yes. Yes, all the addresses here are virtual because they're ones the programs can use. Other questions? Thought there was something. Okay, and we'll do that, and that. Right, and now I have my slides. And on question four, we wanted to do this computation. So we were given a virtual address. We were told where the page table that was single level started. So we just needed to do the computation of virtual page number times number of bytes per page table entry, which is an array lookup. We're getting index 0x12 of the array. That's an array of 8-byte values. And we have to pay attention to the page offset size to figure out that our virtual page number is 0x12 and not like 0x123 or something else. And then question five asked about the value of the page table entry, and we were given an encoding. And that encoding, I've sort of written out the values we want sort of in the order, and the encoding was given from most significant bit to least significant bit. So we have some zeros, then the physical page was 0x90, which we could tell from the final accessed address. We split it up into page offset and physical page number. Then we know it's user accessible, and we know it's readable. We don't know the other bits, so there were multiple possible correct answers. And we also know the valid bit is 1. So we get this bit pattern, and we can convert that to hexadecimal. Questions? That work? Yes.
Why aren't we including all 24 bits of the physical page? Why is it just first?
Question: why aren't we including all 24 bits of the physical page? Why is it just the first two?
Well, not with those two bits, but we're only including 90 instead of
20. Oh, I guess one thing is I realized I miswrote this slide. But. Why am I writing this? Because this is the same thing as writing this for the same.
No, I get that part. Yeah. I'm talking about the meaning. I'm talking about instead of writing 903450, why are we writing 90?
Why are we writing 90? Oh, so 903450, this is our physical address. And the physical address tells us not only what page it's on, but where on that page it is. And we can get that by splitting it up into a physical page number, which was 0x90, and a page offset of 3450. So the bottom 16 bits of this address tell us where in a page it is, because it specifies a particular byte, not like a whole page.
But isn't it still included in the page table entry?
Question, isn't the page offset
included
in the page table entry? No, because the page table entry needs to apply for the whole virtual page. So because it applies to that, because each page table entry should affect a range of addresses that's the size of the page, so 2 to the 16 different possible addresses. And to make that work, we're not using the bottom, in this case, 16 bits of our virtual addresses to look things up in the page tables, and also we need to add back those 16 bits after we get a page table entry, because it has to have 2 to the 16 possible things it can point to. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions, follow-ups? Yeah, And I will need to correct my writing on this slide.
Isn't our answer not 8 bytes
then? Our answer, this answer is also wrong for that reason. So I just can't count when making these slides. So I will correct this slide when I, after this lecture, to not have an extra zero. But isn't our answer 8 bytes? I have not written all the possible leading zeros on that number. But I agree, when you add up the size of all these things, you're going to get that it is 64 bits. But it's just that the first 30 plus bits are zeros. Does that answer your question?
I'm not worried about the leading ones. I'm talking about the ones included in the physical.
In the physical address? Isn't the physical address 8 bytes, you mean?
No, the whole thing should be 8 bytes, but within those 8 bytes, you have 24-bit size physical page. Isn't that whole thing inside within the page table?
Oh, the whole thing, by which you mean, if we look at the whole problem, we're accessing an 8-byte value, is that what you're...
Well, the whole page table entry is 8 bytes, right?
Yes. The whole page table entry is 8 bytes?
Within that 8 bytes, there should be a 24-bit physical page.
Yes. There will be a 24-bit physical page number in those 8 bytes, in the middle of them, which is pure. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
I have a question about question.
Yeah, okay. Yes, so about question three, let me, I didn't put my thing there. Let me actually find my window. Yes, okay, question three. Yeah, what about which part?
So, I probably looked at the man page for MunMath for like a good half an hour, and nothing about map shared specified whether or not MunMath would make that entire process like make that data unavailable.
So question is, what does unmap do in this case? So unmap changes your current process's access to that memory.
Okay.
It has no effect on other processes' access to that memory.
So what would be occurring with that MunMath?
That unmap would basically undo the mmap, for meaning that your process would no longer be able to use p to access that memory. Essentially, it's equivalent to freeing it.
Okay. So it sort of disconnects that like virtual page pointing to the data in physical memory.
It disconnects that virtual page, yeah.
Okay.
And tells the OS that virtual page is now unused.
Sweet.
By you.
Thank you.
Yes, back there. Go ahead. Yeah.
So I was a little bit confused because of how MMAP like works. I guess I was kind of thinking of it in terms of like memory maps IO, but I don't know if that's like accurate. Like, so does it actually allocate physical memory as well as like virtual memory?
Question, does it allocate physical memories? Does MMAP allocate physical memory as well as virtual memory? So MMAP definitely allocates virtual memory. It's unspecified how that virtual memory becomes valid, points to valid useful physical memory. Quite often, as we saw in the VM Explorer lab, it will happen on demand with allocate on demand or something like that. But MMAP promises that those virtual addresses will work, and the OS might do that by setting them up right away or by setting them up when you access them late.
So then does it copy the contents of the file to physical memory?
Because the question is, does it copy the contents of the file to physical memory? When you access it, that needs to happen, yes. Or otherwise, the OS needs to make that access reflect the contents of the file. There might be some other ways of doing that in some cases, but usually it will just copy it.
So then the same file will always have the same physical, if you open the same file, it will always have the same physical
Question, will we always have the same physical memory addresses if multiple programs are accessing the same file? If at the same time, yes, because otherwise, if you're using map shared, yeah, because otherwise that the contents of the file will be two different things. When the homework's not going to be tentative?
Yeah.
Page table? That is an error that is still marked tentative. So right now, let me cue that. I thought I already did that. I guess I did not already do that. Yeah, so that should, page table all should not be tentative. Sorry about that. Other questions? Okay. And question six, we'll go here. Was asking to figure out where the second level page table is looked up. To figure this out, I take our address, I divided it up into our page offset and our virtual page number parts. I think the part that of this problem people had the most trouble with is figuring out how big were those virtual page number parts. And there were two ways you could have figured it out. So one way is we told you the total size of the virtual address, and you could say, well, we know the page offset is 16 bits because you're actually just told that. And all the page tables at every level are the same size. Therefore, we just divide 55, the virtual address size, minus 16, by 3, and we get the size of each virtual page number part, which is 13 bits. Another way you could have told is that there are 8,192 entries, which is 2 to the 13th. And so we need 13 bits to figure out what index in each of the page tables to go to. And the other thing you might have missed is that you need to multiply by 8 because our page table entries were 8 bytes. So if the page table started at, in this case, 540000, we would need to add our virtual page number part times 8. Yeah?
So I think we talked about this before, but is it typically like an odd number when you divide up like after the offset and like maybe each level? Are the bit amounts typically odd or even?
Question, are the bit amounts for the virtual page number parts typically odd or even? That depends on how big the page tables are. It happens that kind of the most common systems you'll see today use 4,096 byte page tables with 8 byte entries, which gives you 9 bits. It used to be the case that they used 4 byte entries, which give you 10 bits. And there might be changes in the future that change that in some other way. Can I go explain what's going, which step here?
How you time the page type, you get after you get the...
Oh, so how I went from what's in the page table entry to the base for the next step?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in our page table entry here, we're going to have something that says valid equals 1 and physical page number equals 0x54. Question. So we're basically just adding 4 zeros? Yes. So one way we can think about this is that we want to get a physical address, which is a physical page number and a page offset. And we have the page number is 0x54. And we need a page offset, so we're going to just fill in a bunch of zeros there. That's one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it is that we're taking the physical page number, which is an index for pages, and multiplying it by the page size to account for pages being more than 1 byte. And we get the same answer in either case, because it's 0x54 is our page number times 0x10000 bytes per page. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, and a brief note on the lab this week. The lab this week is a preview of the topic after the one we're starting today. So today we're going to start talking about caching. That's going to be the next three, this lecture and the next two-ish. And then we'll start going into programming with multiple threads and synchronization. And the lab is a preview of that topic. The lab is in person only. It's probably shorter than the other labs, but it is in person only. If you cannot make the lab, you should talk to me, because there is not something you can submit unless you talk to me. It's all on the lab. Okay, so we're gonna, as I said, the topic we're starting today, which is not with the labs on, is caches. And I believe I showed earlier this semester this picture of a processor from 2004. And we can see that we have, you know, a little bit of the space of the processor devoted to storing registers. We have some space for floating point registers and some space for integer registers, which in this case is right next to the part of the processor that does floating point computations, and the part of the processor that does integer arithmetic and loops and things like that. And then we have some caches. So the processor has some fast storage for data outside of registers that's meant to sort of make memory faster. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is that this is sort of storage on the processor to make memory go faster. And we have some L1. L1 is going to stand for level one. So our first caches, and on this processor, as is typical still today on pretty much any processor you'll see, this L1 cache is actually split for each core into two parts. We have a data cache and an instruction cache. And you can see that these both actually take up a pretty good amount of space of the processor. Like on this processor, this is a single core processor. It had, from 2004, as I said, this is everything that does floating point computations, and our data cache is about as big. So about as much space devoted to storing this data for fast retrieval as like doing floating point division and sine and whatever else the processor can do with floating point instructions. And we have a similar amount of space for storing instructions, machine code, for fast access. And there's also an L2 cache, so a level 2 cache, that we have as kind of a backup if these level 1 caches don't have something. That hopefully it's in this level 2 cache. And we can see that on this design, they devoted basically half of the chip, sort of half of the area of the chip to this level 2 cache. And in this case, it happened that these L1 caches, I think, were about 32 kilobytes apiece, or 16 kilobytes apiece, and the level 2 cache is a megabyte. And if that doesn't work up with the size, I believe the level 2 cache is probably stored a little more compactly. Yes? How quickly does it transition from L1 to L2? So as we'll see when we talk later, basically when the processor wants to get something from memory, it's going to go to the L1 cache. And if the L1 cache doesn't have the value, the L1 cache is going to go to the L2 cache. And if the L2 cache doesn't have the value, it's going to go to the next level and so on until we get to main memory. So on more modern processors, the typical consensus design also has an L3 cache. This processor doesn't, probably because it's a single core. But on multi-core systems, typically the consensus design today, which might change in the future, is that basically every core has its own L1 cache, an L2 cache, and a bunch of cores share an L3 cache. And that's the last level of cache on a chip. It might be the case in the future we'll settle on some other design, you know, maybe L4 caches, or maybe we'll go down to fewer levels, just depending on what processor manufacturers think can make the best performance. But basically when the processor accesses its memory, it goes to the first cache, and that cache goes down the line, and main memory always has the values if they're sort of have a physical address. So questions? This idea. So this sort of idea is sometimes called a memory hierarchy. And sometimes when people are talking about the memory hierarchy, they'll like also add on like SSDs and hard drives. Though that's probably not handled by the hardware automatically. That's something the OS would handle, sort of loading things from or to SSDs and hard drives. And as we go down this hierarchy, the amount of time it takes to access that memory gets longer, but it stores more. So our registers like store a couple kilobytes in total, and main memory stores, you know, these many gigabytes. And accessing a register is really fast, though. Even we don't have much space there, but it's really fast to access on a typical processor. You know, we can effectively access a register in like a fifth of a nanosecond or something, or arguably faster if you kind of count for doing multiple accesses at once. And L1 cache is going to be a bit slower than that, typically. Typically something like 3-ish cycles. And L2 cache even slower, L3 cache slower, and main memory, you know, often, you know, hundreds of cycles. I have some times here that are very approximate, but they're kind of in the right order of magnitude, like plus or minus a factor of 4, depending on the details of our system. But there's this big gap in performance. I'm showing the gap in latency. There's also a gap in bandwidth. That is different, but basically this tells us that we really want to be using these smaller but memories all the time because they're so much faster. And as I said, the way it's going to work is that our CPU is going to talk to the cache, and it's going to request to access memory through the cache, and the cache is going to give the CPU all the values it asks for. Now, it won't always have them, so sometimes it's going to take longer because it's going to go to the next level. In this picture, I only have one level of cache, but if we had more, they'd kind of, yeah, they'd sneak in here, and if this was another cache, it would go to yet another level, potentially, and so we just stack these together. And kind of our goal in doing this is that we want our caches to be kind of, for the processor using it, you know, give us the full performance of that fast memory. So we want to have accessing memory, because the L1 cache takes about a nanosecond, should be about a nanosecond. And obviously that isn't really possible, because isn't really possible to do all the time because, well, we can't fit every value in there, you know. And especially since we want to provide the illusion that we still have access to all the memory. So we want to provide the capacity of the full memory, but we want to have the performance that matches sort of that small memory. So in order to make this to work, we need to have sort of basically like 99%+ of the time, we want to actually have the access not go to the next level. But obviously that's not actually possible because we could get unlucky and the processor could always request things that aren't in that fast small memory and therefore the performance won't be like the fast small memory. But it turns out that real programs are nice and they let us actually basically achieve these two goals. It's not a guarantee, but typically we end up actually achieving these two goals at the same time, even though like it's not possible to do in general. And that's because there's two assumptions that we can make about real programs that are really going to help us out. And we're going to call these temporal locality and spatial locality. So the assumption that we make that we call temporal locality is that if we see a program access a value, now, then it's going to access that value again soon. And the reason that's a nice assumption to make is that it means that if we want to, our cache to take advantage of that, we just need to keep recently accessed values in the cache. And we'll have this spatial locality assumption, which is that if a program accesses a value, it's going to access values that are nearby, so at addresses that are, you know, close numerically, soon. And the caches can take advantage of this by loading not just the single value the processor requests, but a bunch of values around it. And these are things that just happen for free in programs. We don't have to do extra work for almost all programs you write to have a lot of these two properties. And for some intuition on that, let's look at a loop here. This loop is pretty much the natural way of doing the task of computing a mean, and it has very good locality in sort of all the values that are used in it. So one place where we have very little locality for this is in the machine code. And we're going to be mostly focusing on sort of how the data caches work, because that's usually what you as a programmer have more control over. But the performance of caching for instructions is very important. And also, this is a place where caching is very, very effective. And this loop gives us an example as to why. Because if we think of temporal locality, that something being accessed now means it will be accessed again soon, well, all the instructions in the loop, that's true for. Yes, there's some exceptions, but most of the instructions we're fetching are in the loop, like if we just count how many times we fetch things, and most of the time saying, oh, I saw you accessing an instruction in a loop, it's a good guess that you're going to do that again soon. And we also have good spatial locality. If I see the program accessing the instruction that implements this comparison, it's a good guess that probably the next instruction, which is probably like this, the one implementing this addition, is also going to be nearby in memory, and that it should be accessed soon. Like, not guaranteed, but true almost all the time. So we have good spatial locality, that all the machine code for these instructions is nearby. We also have some examples of temporal locality. So we have some variables, total, I, and length, and if we stored them, we'll be accessing them repeatedly, and that means that if these were stored in memory for some reason, then we would be able to take advantage of that by having our cache keep them stored, and we could guess that total's gonna be accessed soon, because when we see an access to total, that means there's gonna be one soon. So we have good temporal locality there. Now, it turns out in practice, that temporal locality, it's very good temporal locality, but our cache probably won't take advantage of it because our compiler will have by putting those values in registers. But if we had too many variables to fit in registers, then they'd go on the stack. The values on the stack would have good temporal locality. The cache would take advantage of that. And we also have good spatial locality. If we look at the accesses to the values array, we're accessing consecutive addresses. So if the cache sees you accessing values of 15, it's a good guess you're going to access values of 16 soon. So if the cache loads groups of values from the array together, that will help you out. So questions? Yes.
These localities, are these two the only two, or is there like a list of sort of like expectations that caches are making?
Question, is there a list of expectations that caches are making that is bigger than this? So there probably are some other things that caches take advantage of in practice. These are definitely the primary ones they're designed to use. Other questions? Okay. So this idea of locality is what makes caches a practical solution for making memory fast. If our programs didn't have these properties, then caches would slow things down, in fact, because we have extra steps to talk to the memory, And if these properties aren't true, most of the time our values won't be in the cache. But fortunately, this sort of just happens by accident. You see here, I didn't like write this code special to make it use the cache well. That kind of just happened for free. And that's sort of why caches are, in practice, very effective at making our memory disappear really fast. And I talked about there being multiple caches, so I note that, typically there's some sharing of caches, as I mentioned earlier. So the most common design you'll see today, if we have multiple cores, each core will have some caches to itself. Typically we'll have separate caches for instructions and data, which is a design decision because that makes it easier to make the processors, and also because probably you want to cache things in a different way for instructions versus data. And we'll have some caches that are shared between cores. So, talked about where caches fit in our access and what properties they'll take advantage of. And now I'm going to get into kind of one of the simplest cache designs, sort of for concretely exactly how a cache can work. I'm going to talk about a particular cache design that I'm going to build up to, which is going to be a direct map cache. But we'll start with something simpler than any real cache, which is going to be a cache that stores one block of data. So I'm going to say I have 2 bytes to store, and I want my cache to store 2 of those bytes. And to keep things simple, I'm going to use this design where I divide memory up into 2-byte chunks, and I'm going to store 1 of those 2-byte chunks in my cache. And the idea is the processor is going to ask me, hey, I would like to read, you know, some value from here. I'd like to read, say, address 01000, so there's 88 here. And the idea is I want my cache to either figure out, oh, I have 8899 stored here, that's from that place, let me give you the 88 from it, or to get that value from memory for us. And we'll use a concrete example of reading, actually, 01011, which we look here is going to be this value here. So we're trying to read this value, and our cache needs to process that read. And we can see here that our cache doesn't have that stored, but the way we see that is by looking at what's in memory. And obviously, that's not an acceptable implementation for the cache because we said the memory's slow. So we need some information to know what is actually stored here. So we need to do some bookkeeping. And in fact, one thing we need to know is, like, is anything even stored there? Like, when we start up our cache, we need to know we don't have anything there. So we're going to do the same thing we did with page tables and have a valid bit. Say, do we even have anything cached yet? So in this case, our valid bit is enough to say, okay, you asked to read from that address. I didn't have anything cached, so I'm going to fetch the block containing that address and put it in my cache. And notice that I made this decision here that even though the processor wanted this byte, I decided I would fetch a whole block containing that. And I've also made a decision that I always fetch a block starting with an even address. And the cache designs that we'll see in the real world do this too. We'll see that it simplifies the bookkeeping if we know that what we have stored always starts at sort of a multiple of something. So now I have something cached, and our idea is that if the processor asks for this value again, we should be able to figure out that it's already cached. So the processor keeps asking for this value. We want to take advantage of that temporal locality. How are we going to do that? Well, this isn't quite enough because we need to know if the processor asks for it again that it's there. So what we're going to do is we're going to have to store some bookkeeping information to figure out where the value came from. And there's some options for how we could do this. So one thing we could do is I could write down in my cache that this value comes from 01010 through 01011, I could write that down. But I'm going to save some space. So if I write down sort of the range of addresses it comes from, well, then I'm writing like 10 bits. But I don't need all those 10 bits. So one way we can save space is that if I know the starting address, I only need to write that. Right. So I don't need the ending address because I know we have 2 bytes. I can do addition. And if I know we always start at an address that's a multiple of 2, I don't need the last bit either. So I'm going to scratch out the end of the range because I can just figure it out from it being 2 bytes we're storing. And I'm going to scratch out this 0 at the end because I know I always start storing these ranges that begin with 0 in the bottom bit. And what I have left over to store, that we call the tag. So the tag uniquely tells us where we got the value from, and we're saving a little bit of space by remembering, you know, I know it's 2 bytes, and I know it starts at an address that's a multiple of 2, so I don't need to store that last 0, I don't need to store the range, I just store the bits that we don't know. Yes?
Sorry, could you clarify the second number after the dash?
Can I clarify the second number after the dash? So we got the value we cached from here. So if I'm writing down the full label, I have this number after the dash that's that the original address plus 1, because we're storing 2 bytes. But I don't need to store that because I can just compute it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And more conveniently, that this tag in this case is everything but the last bit of the address. So we can actually easily take the request from the processor, compare it to our tag, and see if that's what we have cached or not. Okay, so questions? Oops. So after we have this tag, then we're going to need to actually satisfy the read. And we need to figure out, well, the processor is asking for 1 byte. Where do I get that byte from? I have 2 choices. And we're going to look at the last bit of the address to figure that out. And we're going to call this last bit the offset. So we're actually splitting up our address into a tag and an offset. And I might sometimes write block offset so we know it's not the same thing as the page offset. Because this is for caches, not for virtual memory. And we have, in this case, we have 1 bit to determine which of the 2 parts of the block we're in, and we have 4 bits to determine the tag to figure out where did this block come from and does it match the one we're looking for. Questions about our very simple cache? Okay, so this scheme works for a cache, and it's a little too simple, though. And probably one big thing that's a problem is that we can only cache sort of 1 thing at a time, and if we want to make our cache bigger, we're caching sort of 1 part of memory and not others. That's not very nice. So we're going to want to have multiple blocks. And I'm going to talk about one scheme of doing that called a direct map cache. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to duplicate this design a bunch of times. We're basically going to have 4 or more multiple copies of this design at once. And we're going to divide off our memory among those copies. So I'm going to have 4 blocks in this case, my example. We could have more in other examples. Well, for reasons you'll see later, we're always going to choose a power of 2. And I'm going to decide that when the processor asks to read a particular byte, that there's a particular row that we're going to store that in, or we're not going to store it at all. So we're going to have 1 place that every part of memory can go to. And the way I'm going to assign that is I'm going to say that the first part of memory can go to the first block, this, and the fifth part of memory can go to the first block, and the ninth part of memory, and so on. So every four blocks of memory go to the first block, every four blocks go to the second block, and so on, just dividing up the memory evenly among my blocks in my cache. And this scheme is known as direct mapped. And I'm dividing it up so that each block sort of is responsible for things that are spread out as far as possible. And the reason for that is that we want it to be the case if we have like an array that we can store as much of that array as possible. And by spreading it out, we're going to spread out the array among all the blocks and make that happen. And also this scheme is going to allow us, because I chose a power of two number of blocks, to you have an index for the blocks, which is, you know, 0 to 3 in this case, that matches the bits of the address. So even though I kind of, you know, initially explained this scheme as, you know, we're just splitting up the blocks evenly, the way I've done it, I can just look at some bits of the address and determine what row to go to. And that's really useful because in the hardware, we want to quickly find the right row. So in this case, the processor asked to access an address which had 0, 1 in those two bits we said matched up with the sort of mapping here. So we're going to look in the second row, the row with index 1. And that's where we're going to store the value. But we still need to actually have that extra bookkeeping we saw with the one block cache. And the reason we need it is that we have multiple things that could end up being stored there. We could be storing 2, 3, 2, 3, 3 from addresses 2 to 3, or we could store the value the processor is looking for, some more that aren't shown on this picture. Right? There's lots of different addresses that have those two bits matching. So we have sort of, so we've split up our values among the blocks, but we still need to do the same bookkeeping to figure out, is there something stored and where did it come from? And I'm going to use the same scheme we saw with the one block. I'm going to have a valid bit to say, is there even anything in this row? And I'm going to have a tag to say where it came from. And I'm going to save even more space on my tags this time. So previously with our tags, I omitted just the last bit because I knew, well, every block has a 0 for the last bit and a 1 for the last bit, and that just matches the address. We don't need to store it. But I can actually save even more bits because if we think of what happened, we know that if something's in this row, that the index bits, those two bits of the address, in this case, match up with that row. That tells us there. We know the last bit has the whole range depending on where in the block we are, which we can get from the original address. So we only need the leftover bits to store as our tag. So I'm storing only 0, 1 because I know anything in this row is going to be, you know, have the 0, 1 from the index as the next bits, and it's going to range from 0 to 1 in that last bit because each block it has the 0, you know, the even address and the odd address. Right. So the tag is just disambiguating. You know, we can see from, you know, is it 0, 0, meaning it's this 2, 2, 3, 3? Is it 0, 1, meaning it's AABB? Or is it like 1, 0, which would be 1, 0, 0, 1, 0 through 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, or so on? We only have four possibilities based on what row it's in, which is why we only need two bits for the tag in this case. Questions? Oh, yes. Yes. So we're going to use the index and tag to determine where the address is. So we're going to use the index to determine where it might be stored and the tag to verify that it actually is there.
Yeah, so if there are more options in the memory, like more addresses in that memory, and you should add more columns in the cache, or you just expand the index?
So the question is, if we wanted to add more blocks, what would we do? So the simplest thing to do that keeps with the scheme is that we'll add more index bits and add more rows. We'll see that there's something else we can do called an associative cache that we'll talk about later. That's a more complicated option. Yes?
So the index bits themselves, are they kept with the valid bit in the tag, or are they just assumed to be in the order that we store our cache?
Question, where are the index bits stored? If at all, they are not stored. They're just the row number. Just like if I have an array, I don't store the array indices. Question, the cache is going to be ordered like an array? Yes. So basically the index will be an address. So the cache like is kind of like a specialized memory, and the machinery that accesses that will use the index to form the address to that specialized memory. Yeah?
Just to make sure I understand, does the tag tell you which address you want to use, and the index tells you which bit you want to access?
Does the tag tell you which address you want to use, and index tell you which bit you want to access? So the index tells us where the value could potentially be,
like the byte, like
which row it could potentially be in. That's the index. And the tag tells us if there's a value there, does it actually come from there, or is it from one of the other places it could come from? And we also, as we're determining which of the part of the block it's from, that's going to be what we call the block offset. So our address is going to be divided up into a tag, an index, which I will sometimes call a set index for reasons we'll see later. We'll call these rows sets. And an offset, which I'll sometimes call a block offset, so we know it's not a page offset. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, how is the cache fast if we have lots of rows?
Yeah, because you have a lot of logs, and you have the embedded index, and you have to search for
You have to search for a particular. So I guess, so even though the cache has a lot of, so I guess there's two things that are going on. So one is that, as we'll find out later, there's some designs which don't have as many rows. But even if we do use this direct map design, the number of rows we have compared to like rows in memory is so much less that it's, you know, that the cost of getting to the right row is not a big deal. Also, the way caches are laid out physically, basically you store the rows together and you have some circuitry that activates the right row with the typical technology that's used for it. And you can maybe split that up into separate banks, and it's relatively fast to add extra rows, as long as it doesn't get too physically big. I'm not saying that's the best thing to do all the time, but like the key thing that will make these caches efficient is that they won't be that big, right? So even if we have like you know, 100,000 rows, that's still way smaller than main memory, and therefore can be a lot faster. Yeah?
Are index and tag always the same number of bits?
Absolutely not. Is the tag always the highest order bits? Yes. So we always want, because we're picking things together in memory, the offset's always the lowest bits. And we could hypothetically have a cache where we use some bits that are somewhere, you know, not right next to the offset for the index bits. But that would mean like that if we had an array, that we couldn't store like two consecutive parts of the array at the same time. And that's a bad idea if we assume programs have spatial locality. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so some terminology. I'm gonna call the rows of our caches sets, and this is preparation for later on when we're gonna go beyond this direct map design and store multiple blocks in a set. And also because, of course, physically it doesn't have to be laid out in rows. I want to be clear on that, using rows in the sense of the drawings I'm showing so far. And I mentioned that our addresses are split up into a tag, index, and offset, and you can figure out how many bits we need for each of those parts of the address based on the layout of our cache. And we can change the number of rows, number of sets, which will change the number of index bits. We can change the size of blocks, which will change the number of offset bits. And the tag is just whatever's left over. So in this case, I have a 6-bit address because I want to fit my addresses on this slide. And we can look at how is this split up for each of these three caches. So we can see here that we have, if we look at this first cache here, our values, assuming these are 2 bytes, we have 2-byte values here. So we have 2 bytes blocks, which means that we need 1 bit to determine which part of the block we're in, right? And if we're labeling the bytes of the block, we'd label them 0 and 1. We need 1 bit for that. So the least significant bit of our address for those two caches is going to be the offset. We have this other cache here where we have 4 bytes in each block, which means we need 2 bits to determine the offset. Because if we label these individual bytes, we're going to have 0001, 1011. We need 2 bits to do that. So that means if we're thinking of this address up here, that the offset will be 1 for the first 2 caches and 1-1 for the last one because of that different number of bytes per block. And as for the index, that's going to depend on number of sets. So this first cache here has 4 sets, so we need 2 bits to determine which set to go to. So we're going to have, for this first cache, we're going to have our index as the next 2 bits. Here we have our cache down here, has 2 sets, so we need 1 bit to determine which one to go to. And you can see that if we went down to 1 set, we need 0 bits to determine it, and that's how our 1-block cache, I never talked about index bits. That's just a special case. And we have this cache over here where we needed 3 bits to determine which of the 8 sets to go to. And those 3 bits are going to be, you know, the next bits after the offset. And our tag is just whatever is left over. So notice that when I split these addresses up into tag, index, and offset, if I combine them back together, I always get the original address back. And so the tag is just whatever was left over after we took off the offset and took off the index. So questions? How I did this. Yes?
Well, I was just wondering, like, you sort of have these different configurations. So since the index can kind of be, like, abstracted away in, like an array, is the best solution to use a scheme that has a larger index so that you have to store, like, effectively store fewer values to specify the address?
So the question is, do we want to have lots of index bits? So there's a cost to that, and part of the cost is that we need to physically store separate values. Another cost is that we're thinking of taking advantage of spatial locality. We really want to store bigger blocks, and storing bigger blocks and storing the same amount of stuff means having fewer rows, fewer sets. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So we know about tag, index, and offset, and we know about sets. One other piece of terminology I'm going to give is cache size. So if we look at the caches I've shown you, we're storing a bunch of stuff that isn't data. When people say you have a 1 megabyte cache, they mean the data part of the cache is 1 megabyte. They are not including any of the metadata the cache might be storing, like a tag and the valid bits and so on. So when we talk about cache sizes, we always mean the amount of data. Also, another thing is when I talk about cache sizes, I always mean powers of 2. Powers of 2. And generally, people designing caches always mean powers of 2 for things like megabytes, because if we saw that the cache kind of inherently needs to be built on powers of 2. So this means that 1 megabyte for this purpose is going to be 2 to the 20 bytes, not 1 million. And the same thing for 1 kilobyte is going to be 2 to the 10 bytes, not 1,000, because it kind of has to be related to a power of 2. Yes? So as we'll learn later, it is possible with other cache designs to have this total cache size not be a power of 2, but it's still going to be related to 1. So like, there are processors you can get with a 6 megabyte cache, but that's really 6 times 2 to the 20 bytes, not 6 times a million. And we kind of figured out how these properties worked, you know, from looking at the diagram. I recommend being able to do that, to reason about it, but you can also kind of write these down as formulas. That we can say, oh, the number of sets is 2 to the number of index bits, and the number of index bits is, you know, therefore we can take the log base 2 of the number of sets. The block size is 2 to the number of block offset bits. The tag is the address bits minus the set index bits minus the block offset bits. And the cache size is the number of blocks times the number of sets. So the block size times the number of sets. Number of sets is the number of blocks. So questions on where all these formulas come from? I hope that you can figure them out from the diagrams earlier without needing to like memorize them. Okay, so let's do a little exercise. So let's say I have a cache with 64 byte blocks and 128 sets that stores 8 kilobytes of data. So the first question is, if we have 32-bit addresses, how much of the address is tag, index, and offset? And the second question is, once you figure that out, it's going to help you to figure out, okay, which of these things are going to be stored in the same block as the byte we get from address 0x1037? Meaning that if I ask the cache to read me a byte from address 1037, it's going to have stored not only 1037 in the cache, but also a bunch of other things that are nearby. Which of these things are some of those nearby things? Thank you. Okay, can someone start tell me about the first parts? What's a good first step for finding our tag index and offset? Yes. What do you think is a good first step for start? Number of sets, which is 128, is the index bits, yes. Bits, and log base 2 of 128 happens to be 7, so we have 7 index bits. And the same process applies to our block size for the block offset. So we'll get log base 2 of the block size, which is 64 bytes, gives us 6 offset bits. Determine which byte of the block. So we have 6 offset bits, 7 index bits, and the tag is everything left over. So we have our address has an offset that is 6 bits, an index that is 7 bits, or I should write in a consistent place. And the tag is everything left over, which is going to be 32 minus 7 plus 6 bits. Some questions? Figure that out. Now let's see, since we're out of time, I'll just go through my answer to this part. So we have this address here. I want to split it up into a tag index and offset. So I have 10000011011, and this is our offset, the last 6 bits, and this is our index, these 7 bits here. And therefore, the block starts at offset 0 and goes to the maximum offset. So the block is 0x100 through 0x103f inclusive. So this is offset 0 to offset 1111 with the same index bits and the same tag. And that means that these first 3 are in the same block, the next one isn't. So notice that when we access this value that's in the middle of the block, the cache loads the block from the beginning, meaning that even if that's the first address we access, the cache is not going to load x1041 because that goes in a different set, a different row. We always keep the right thing in the correct each row. Yes? How did I get, calculation index off to 103f? So 1000 is the same tag and index and offset of 0. 103f is if I replace the offset zeros with all offset value with all ones.
Okay.
So I just said 11111.
Okay.
And I think out of time.